You're listening to the Writers Forum. I'm your host, Mike Tusa, and today I'll be interviewing author Ashley Winstead about her new book, Midnight is the Darkest Hour. Ashley holds a PhD in contemporary American literature from Southern Methodist University, and she has written four other novels to high acclaim. Welcome to the show, Ashley.
Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's talk about the new book, Midnight is the Darkest Hour. And you start off the book with a content warning. Talk to me about that.
Yes. So this is something that I've done since the first book, the first thriller that I've written. And at the time, I didn't realize that I was doing anything particularly novel. But it turns out that there is this big conversation, this big discourse, especially among crime fiction readers and writers, over content warnings and whether or not to include them at the beginning of books, and whether or not they are spoilers. I do it because I write about trauma pretty consistently. And I write about characters who are through a lot of different means. Sometimes it's cutting an enemy's head off. Sometimes it's, you know, the talking cure, whatever it is. My characters are grappling with trauma and searching for catharsis. And to my mind, the last thing that I want to do to my reader is re-traumatize them if my book is going to tread over territory that will be hard for them to deal with. So I think the very least I can do as an author who's sensitive about trauma is just to say, like, hey, these common trigger topics are going to come up in this book, so prepare yourself.
I've got you. Well, how would you, I read the book and really enjoyed it. Would you describe the genre, though, of the book to somebody who's interested?
The hardest question you could possibly ask me. The genre of this book is, it's crime fiction. So I'm going to use that really, really wide umbrella. But I went into writing this book knowing that I was going to mesh genres, blur genres, because I wanted to write what, to me, I call this my fairy tale thriller. Mm-hmm. So I'm skirting supernatural, paranormal fiction, playing with a lot of tropes, playing with, there's a really heavy romance plot in this book as well. So I'm really trying to kind of like greedily gobble up as many different and present as many different genres as I can in this book, probably more so than any of my previous books I set out to.
You know, it works really well.
Thank you.
One of the things that struck me, and I'm always interested in when writers like yourself go below the veneer of everyday mm-hmm. living into the hardwood, the trauma, as you call it, but the hardwood where people have to reflect. And there's so many universal themes in this book that was struck with me anyway, and that's always good, good writing. Now, the novel is set in the fictional town of Bottom Springs, Louisiana, but it references areas around Lafayette, Louisiana, which I'm very familiar with. Did you have to do any research on Louisiana or Lafayette before writing it, or were you already familiar with the area?
So I was in some ways familiar with the area because I've had family live in New Orleans for many years. And so I would drive around Southern Louisiana, road trips, vacations, and just became really fascinated by Louisiana. But I also, on top of that, of course, had to do a lot of research. So the amount of like Louisiana wildlife, you know, like Audubon sort of things that I was consulting and doing, zooming in on maps and doing Google image searches and Google map searches, and trying to really kind of immerse myself. And there were a few trips that I took where I just sat around in little towns, gas station-esque restaurants off highways and kind of listened to the patter of conversation. And so it was a mix of familiarity, but also really having to educate myself.
Well, again, it works well and it doesn't come across, you know, sometimes when writers write about the bayou or about Louisiana, it's a bit hokey. And this was not the case.
I was terrified of that. Yes, I was very terrified of that. Well, so I'm glad to hear.
Thankfully, you didn't use share in every other sentence. Which was,
I'm having PTSD flashbacks to books that I've read that did that. So,
All right. Now, I found this fascinating, though, because it's another, what I think is a universal theme anyway. In describing Bottom Springs,
yeah,
you write, quote, "This is a Southern Baptist country, and people are prone to unease, apocalyptic, and overly associative, seeing holy warnings in the smallest things," close quote. This is a tough question. What is it about Southern Baptists that lends itself to a certain degree of caricature?
Yeah, I love that. Just come out swinging, huh? So the religion in Midnight is the Darkest Hour is a little bit of a cheat, because I chose Southern Baptist because that's the experience that I had growing up. That was the church that my parents belonged to. That's the church that I witnessed a lot of hypocrisy, caricature, to use your word. And I will just go farther and say some downright evil in my experience. But I also wove into the particular Southern Baptists of Midnight a lot of other religions. So kind of more of the Pentecostal strains of snake handling, speaking in tongues. And so that required a lot of research. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to go for it and make this a kind of religion that everyone is devoted to in the book, a kind of amalgamation of Christian, Southern Christian sects that just fascinate me with their strangeness. But for me, the hypocrisy that I witnessed and the caricature ability, I'm making up words here, really had a lot to do with gender roles and power in Southern Baptist Church. So as a young woman growing into adulthood, being told things by my pastor and my elders about, men's role versus women's roles in families and society, going to youth group, growing up and having a lot of fear, experiencing a lot of fear mongering over my purity and my virginity, and having those really strangely intimate conversations with, youth pastors, and also witnessing good friends in that church who I was a kid growing up until I very markedly left the church and had a huge blow up with my family who is still involved. But witnessing friends whose fathers were being abusive, beating them, beating their wives, and then covered over by the church.
Well, it's interesting because what struck me, and I picked up the amalgamation you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the next question I had was to ask whether you had some experience with some type of evangelical type religion, because it's so honest a rendering of it. And at the same time, not being completely stereotypical about them. I mean, there's depth to it. All right. So let's talk more about the book. In the book, your main character is Ruth. I'd like to meet her one day, by the way. But anyway, your main character and her father is the pastor, James Cornier.
Yeah.
By the way, when I think of, I always bring in music. When I think of the pastor Cornier, the way you describe him, there's an Andrew Duhon song in which he says, quote, "She was caught with a boy. She was caught with a cigarette. Jesus might forgive you, but the preacher's never going to forget."
That's so good.
And that struck me as being relevant to your pastor. But talk to us about the relationship between Ruth and her father.
Yeah, so I love that question. And it turns out that I'm always writing bad father, someone recently pointed out to me. And I would just like to say for the record that I had a great father, loved my father. But I am fascinated with patriarchy and paternalism, I guess more largely. And so that often comes across in my work, being figured by father figures and a literal paternal figure. So Ruth's father is both this man. Ruth wants so much love from her parents, from her mother and her father, that she doesn't get. And her father is essentially the king or the mayor figure in their small town of Bottom Springs, because it's a theocracy, more or less, as it is in some small southern towns. And so to her father, Ruth is just his progeny, yet another person to control. And even more important to control, because she wears his last name and she is an extension of him and their family's good name. So there's no one in the town, I write this in the book, that is on a shorter leash than Ruth, because, you know, she's a teenage girl and must be controlled, lest she sour their last name. So theirs is a really fraught relationship of Ruth wanting closeness and intimacy, and her father really not being interested in that from anyone, including her, and really just wanting her to be controlled.
Well, and I got right away, you get the impression that he is worried that he will somehow be judged by her. Not right. That she will judge him, but others will judge him by however she presents, however she lives.
Yes.
Now, in the book, the narration, as it relates to Ruth in particular, goes back and forth between her different ages.
Yeah.
I'm always curious, as a writer, how do you do that without breaking the narrative flow, you know, where people don't suddenly look at a chapter and go, okay, what just happened?
Yeah, that is such a great, great craft question that I struggle with, honestly, and it requires so much work as you're, for me, maybe some writers do it effortlessly, but I love non-linear timelines. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always trying to figure out how to do it in a way that doesn't throw the reader and does feel seamless. And so the ways that I figured out how to do it are, A, most obviously, like clear time markers. Like I'm not going to make you guess where we are. I'm just going to say this is August, you know, she's of 20, whatever, she's 17 years old here. So you know that up front. But also I like to link the, more importantly, if in the present timeline, you are encountering like you've met a new person has been introduced. That flashback that I'm going to take you in the next chapter is the first time maybe that Ruth has met that person. So now you're getting this backstory. So you're like, okay, this is flowing. Or the backstory is there because it's thematically linked to something that's happening in the present. Or it's going to throw a huge wrench on what you just thought you figured out in the present. So it really trying to tie it all together.
Well, the segues work well. Again, I didn't feel lost in any of it. But let me ask this. When you write the different time periods, do you write the chapters sequentially, or do you write the time periods and then fit them back in where you think they belong?
I write exactly how it's presented in the book. And I do that in part because I want that experience as a writer and a reader of, is this making sense for this one thing to flow into the next? I worry that it would feel disjointed if I wrote all the past and all the, and then I would just get too used to it in my brain thinking like, well, that's the way it's supposed to be, and not be able to see, you know, the forest for the trees sort of thing, putting it together.
All right. Well, the other main character in the book, who I also fell in love with, is Everett. And maybe there's a little bit of self-reflection there. I'm not sure. Anyway, he's an outsider in Bottom Springs, as is Ruth, but in different ways, obviously. They both share a love of reading. Did you know, and this may go back to character development versus plot, did you know that these two would become friends at the outset, or did their friendship evolve organically as you wrote?
Yeah, to me, this book was always about the two of them. And so as much, even though Ruth is our focalization character, where we're getting the book through her perspective, Everett is almost just as much a main character. And he's her foil in every way, where she is the pastor's daughter and the model of good girlhood. He is the, like you said, the town outcast, and his father's own outcast nature and horrible, you know, addiction to alcohol is the thing that makes Everett, you know, untouchable and disgusting to these hypocritical Christians in Bottom Springs. And so their friendship is one that shouldn't happen. Like, they shouldn't be friends. They shouldn't have this sort of intimacy, but of course they have so much in common in that they both don't fit in. They're both outcasts in their own ways. So yeah, from the very beginning vision I had for this book, it was these two characters, light and dark, meeting, either one, both of them pulling the other in their respective directions and trying to figure out, you know, where that moral center was when nothing made that they were presented with made logical sense to them.
Well, you know, it struck me, I think all of us, if we're old enough, have been told in relationships, you should never think the other person will save you, right?
Yes.
But in a very real sense, Ruth and Everett save each other.
Oh, I had
their statement.
That is so beautiful. I think that's at the heart of the book, is me exploring that. Both the you shouldn't ever expect someone to save you. That's Ruth's big flaw, is she falls in love with romance stories and thinks that she's waiting for someone to come and save her. And yet the way life bears out sometimes, and when you reflect on it, you realize moments in which people do save you and you do offer that sort of grace and outstretched hand to other people. And so, yeah, I was really trying to have my cake and eat it too with that.
But again, it works. I couldn't decide whether they saved each other or they redeemed each other. I don't know that there's a difference, but I thought about it as I was reading. You mentioned, you know, Ruth with romance. And I'm too old for this, and I have to tell you, but one of the things she's enamored with is the Twilight novels.
Yeah.
Which I know very little about. Talk to us about what Ruth gets out of those novels, however. I've guessed, but...
Yeah. Know. No, and it's so funny because people think that, a lot of readers thought that I wrote this book with Twilight, like knowing that Twilight was going to be Ruth's obsession and it was going to... Mm-hmm. That it had a really big role to play in the book. And honestly, I did not. Twilight came later in my writing process. What I knew going into writing this book was that Ruth... because she wasn't in love with and not enamored with religion and couldn't find passion and something to live for in Southern Baptism, she would have something else. And this is me drawing from my own experience and giving it to Ruth. But for her, that was books, literature. That's what she fell in love with. And in particular, you know, as a young girl growing up, like a lot of us, a young woman, she fell in love with the idea of romance and someone, this invisible girl who felt invisible, someone seeing you and choosing you above all other people in the world. And so I was thinking to myself, what book could I choose that Ruth would find, and it would be a banned book because it has to do with paranormal and supernatural, and that you can't read, you know, like Harry Potter or Twilight in Bottom Springs. What book could I plausibly choose that would cause a 14-year-old girl, which is how old she is when she finds it, to just become obsessed? And I remembered the Twilight mania of, you know, it's now like 10, 20 years ago, something alarmingly far in the past. And I remember Twilight Mania and how obsessed so millions of teenage girls got with Edward Cullen, the vampire at the heart of Twilight. And I was like, this is so perfect, because having Ruth fall in love with Twilight, it fits the vampire theme that I have going on with the low man and the, you know, the vampiric authoritative men in this town who are sucking the blood out of the people. And it allows me to kind of gently question the, what falling head over heels in love with, like, the idea of love or someone saving you, like you said, gives young women, because that was a really big question I wanted to explore.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's not the only book. And I, of course, as somebody who reads, I was struck by how many other quotes there are in the book that Everett or Ruth kind of give back and forth to each other. And it was really good as far as their character development. But that raises a question for me always about inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever get story ideas or character ideas from reading other writers' work?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that that's the number one source of inspiration for me. So I rarely have writer's block, because when I'm starting to feel uninspired or stuck, I'm like, let's go encounter some good art. Let's go watch a great film. Let's go to the museum and look at some visual art. Let's read a great book. And the inspiration isn't like, oh, I'm reading, you know, Rebecca, and so I'm now going to write a book that, you know, follows Rebecca. But I'll read Rebecca and think to myself like, oh, obsession. Yes, there's something here about obsession. Woman on woman obsession, you know, and that'll be just how the seed starts. So yeah. And since I have a graduate degree in literature, I'm constantly working against myself and battling myself, trying to restrain myself of just writing thrillers that are like literary illusion after literary illusion, because that's how my brain works, for better or worse. But I kind of let my freak flag fly in Midnight more than my previous books, just kind of because Ruth and Everett love books too. So they're constantly quoting at each other.
You know, and you know what maybe might come out of that, I guess? We've all read a book, maybe even it's history or nonfiction, that cites something else. And we're so interested by the book, we decide to go look up this other book or whatever.
Yeah.
And I know it struck me that some folks reading Midnight might see some of those quotes, unfamiliar with them, and say, I need to find out more about that. So that's
a dream. Yeah, I love that. I also had great fun because originally I went to get my PhD in contemporary poetry, like 20th century American poetry, which is no longer contemporary, I know. But I had a lot of fun, particularly with slightly altering quotes from poets that Everett says to Ruth to make them tailored to her. And I was like, I don't know if anyone other than my weird little group of fellow 20th century American poets will get that this line is slightly tweaked, but I'm just going to put this little Easter egg in here.
Yeah, well, you can do that with the characters. Yeah. All right, so back to reality here for a second.
Yeah.
There is a bar in the novel called the Blue Moon.
Yes. Now,
this may say more about me, but I have to ask, is that a nod to the Blue Moon Saloon, which actually is in Lafayette, Louisiana?
It is not. And I am learning that that exists right now. And I'm very delighted that the Blue Moon is my purely out of my imagination and is a bar that I just wish I could go to.
Well, you can go, you can actually stay because it's also a guest house. But
oh my God.
Yeah. All right. Now, authors will often tell me that if they create a good character or good characters, that the character will actually help write the book.
Yeah.
To the non-writer, that sounds bizarre, right?
Yeah.
I even had an author one time tell me that he'll sometimes have his characters do something and the character will say, nope, I'm not going to do that, which sounds a little psychotic. But did you have that experience with Ruth or Everett? And did one more than the other help with the writing of the story?
Oh, I love that question so much. And I'm going to confess, even though I feel like maybe this makes me not a real writer, that I am also mystified by when writers say that. And I think it tends to be more the pantsers writers, you know, the folks who sit down without a outline and let the story kind of flow through them. That's not the kind of writer I am. I am one of those like extreme type A people who I do incredible character development work using a book called Story Genius by Lisa Cron. She's a neuroscientist. And so I develop my characters. I then write wildly long 42 to 45 page outlines of my book where I write down scene by scene what happens in my novels. So I essentially write my book before I ever sit down to draft it. And then when I finally get to the drafting part, That's where I let the other part of my brain, the creative artist part, take over. And so, and I'll start drafting. And I do have the experience sometimes where I thought in my outlines that something is going to happen. And as I'm writing, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel emotionally true. It doesn't, you know, that part of your brain that has an instinct for human beings and what human beings are apt to do, I think is what writers are talking about when they say like, oh, my character said this. It's really, you know, the emotional logic of the story you've set up.
Well, but this is interesting to me because like James Patterson, I interviewed some of the guys that write with him and they say he sends an outline of everything. I mean, completely. Yeah. But I assume that doesn't mean you don't live with your characters while you're writing.
No, that's absolutely right. In fact, I feel like writing, getting all the scaffolding in place, which is what I do with the outline, mm-hmm. actually frees me to feel like, okay, you can let go and sink into this story because you have a roadmap for where you're going to go. And you're there's part of my brain that's always like, okay, where are we? And, you know, it's playing the navigator, but the large part of my brain is spending time with my characters and with my first drafts. I always write a solid 20 to 50,000 words over the mark because I know it's a pain in the ass because I have to then whittle all those words down. But I let myself do that because I'm truly allowing myself to sink into the characters. And if a character wants to go off on a tangent about some book she's read, you know, I'm going to let her. And then I'll come back and cut it to one line. But
that does sound like they're writing the story a little bit for you. All right, let me end with this, okay? It's always struck me that if you write fictional characters and then you, in your case, outline them in depth, and then you put them in a certain situation that they have to work their way through, what do you learn about yourself?
Gosh. Oh, that is the question. And I think I write all of my books to learn about myself. Mm-hmm. And each book I'm writing to learn something different about myself with Midnight or heal something about myself. So with Midnight, I am asking questions to myself as much as the reader about what real justice looks like, about why, if there's any reason to be good in this world, if we're all, you know, animals, and what goodness and rightness and wrongness looks like, and how to heal yourself from trauma imposed on you, inflicted on you in your teenage years. So those are all questions that I was asking myself for very personal reasons that I hope my readers also asking. But for each of my books, it's a different set of questions that I ask that always feel very uncomfortable, like this white hot discomfort to be asking myself these questions in a public forum, like a novel. And I know that I haven't gotten to the right questions unless they make me deeply uncomfortable. So
I got you. Well, you know, a dear friend of mine who's a writer and who writes poetry and fiction says poetry is acute pain and fiction is dull pain.
Oh gosh. What a beautiful quote. And so true.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Folks, you've been listening to the Writers Forum, and I've been speaking with author Ashley Winstead about her new book, Midnight is the Darkest Hour. Ashley, is there a website or other social media site folks can go to in order to learn more about you and your writings?
Yes, I'm on Instagram too much at the handle Ashley Winstead Books. And you can also find me on my website at www.ashleywinstead.com.
Folks, it's a really good book. Midnight is the Darkest Hour. I encourage you to pick it up. Ashley, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mike. It was such a joy.
Folks, music for the show is provided by Valerie Hunt Jester, and the show is produced by our very own Tyler O'Brien. Tune in Tuesdays at 4:00 in the afternoon or Wednesdays at 5:30 in the morning to hear the next segment of the Writers Forum.
Thank you.